Hi, David.
Hi, Amy. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, good.
We should introduce ourselves for the Blogging Heads viewers. I
Okay.
am Amy Sullivan, and I'm a writer with Time Magazine.
And I'm David Gibson. This is my first time here on Blogging Heads TV. I'm a
So,
cover religion at politicsdaily.com.
well, welcome to your Blogging Heads debut. It's
Thank you
very
very much.
exciting. We are going to be talking about all religion today. And just to give the folks a sense of what we're going to cover, the main things in the religion world this week, it seems like, are the National Day of Prayer kerfuffle that's come up with the proclamation being declared unconstitutional, what the White House is going to do in the wake of that. The question of whether we are soon going to have a Supreme Court with no Protestants on it, which would be a first for the history of the court. There seem to be a few things going on in the Catholic Church, I've read. So,
And yes, just came back from there, under the cloud of ash, which made for all kinds of wonderful metaphors. You had your leads
I
written for
bet.
you for every story.
Well, you can tell us all sorts of stories from
Yes.
Rome. And then immigration reform has, I don't know, at least three or four times this week, seemed like it was picking up momentum and then getting shelved for the year and then picking up momentum again. So we can talk about the role that religious groups have had in trying to push that forward this year. And then I know it's been a little while now since health reform, but I have been wanting to explore kind of the future of the pro-life Democrat and whether they're a soon-to-be extinct species or whether health reform was just kind of a blip in terms
Who
of
wants to be the next
that.
Bart Stupak?
Exactly. Does
Nobody.
anybody want to be the
Raise your
next
hand.
Bart Stupak?
No.
So why don't we start with the National Day of Prayer, because that is coming up pretty soon. And I know you wrote when the court ruling first came down about that. Do you have any thought since then in terms of what this is going to mean?
Well, it's going to mean it's going to be a political issue, I think, more than anything. As soon as that ruling came down, you knew it was kind of red meat to the tossed out to the religious right. And in fact, the Obama administration turned around the Justice Department turned around pretty quickly and announced they would appeal the court ruling by the federal district judge in Wisconsin. And whether they can get out in front of that ruling, I really doubt. It's the kind of thing, and even whether that ruling will be sustained, I actually have great doubts. Jay Sekulow at the American Center for what is it, the American Center for Liberty?
Justice and law or something.
Justice and Law, the Christian rights version of the ACLU. Suggested that this case would go all the way to the Supreme Court, and as we saw in the in this week's ruling in Salazar versus Buono, the Mojave
The
Cross
cross
case, which we can
case.
also talk about. I just don't think the Supreme Court is going to side with this Judge Crabb in Wisconsin. So, but in the meantime, it's going to make for great political theater. And and that, and also combined with, again, none of these things happen in isolation, combined with the disinvitation to Franklin Graham to at the National Day of Prayer event at the Pentagon because of Graham's past comments vis-a-vis Islam. Is that legit?
Well,
Is that le is that a
and
legit disinvitation? Religious leaders say a lot of things.
well, and maybe we should back up for a second and make clear that there are a couple of things going on with the National Day of Prayer. One is a proclamation that the president, I think since the late 50s, has issued, kind of declaring a day of prayer. And I'm forgetting the precise language of the proclamation, but it's something like calling on all Americans to pray on the day that
Yeah,
the
since
proclamation is
1952,
issued.
and of course, some people trace it back to the founding fathers as well.
Right. But officially, it's been
Yeah.
something that the president has done for the last 50 or so years. But there's also more recently, and this is just within the last 20 or 25 years, been a national day of prayer celebration to go with it, sometimes held at the White House. Often there's a separate celebration. And that has become increasingly sectarian, and I think that's the concern a lot of people have. There's definitely a mixed opinion on whether there should even be a national day of prayer. But the fact that there's now this task force that puts together a national day of prayer event and kind of tries to adopt an official kind of sanction because of this proclamation, and the task force is now run by James Dobson's wife, Shirley Dobson, and in the past has really limited the participation to evangelical Christians and even their kind of a certain bent of evangelical Christians. I think a couple years ago, Mormons were kept out of the event, even if they wanted to participate. And so that's kind of, I think, added some political stakes to this, because if there were to be no national proclamation, they would take that as kind of shutting them down as well.
But weren't they also?
Which may be one reason the White House is going ahead.
Yeah, and they were also put out already. The fact that President Obama issued the proclamation last year, his first as president, but he did not participate at the actual events.
Right, which wasn't incredibly surprising, but definitely was a change from the 8 years of Bush.
Yeah, and this is, again, it's one of those events, much like you could argue the National Prayer Breakfast has become kind of a captive of certain religious right organizations. So consequently, it's a different animal than it was in the 1950s when you kind of had this civil religion, this civic religion, which kind of everybody bought into, whether you were Catholic, Protestant, Jew at the time. And it's, but as you say, it's become much more sectarian, and which kind of, in a sense, opens the door to court rulings like we saw this week.
Right. Do you think Obama could get away with just saying, all right, it's declared unconstitutional, we don't really need a national day of prayer anyway, people who want to pray are already praying, people who don't have faith and don't pray certainly don't need this?
No, he wouldn't get away with that, and he wouldn't want to. I think he'd that would just confirm every worst suspicion about him, and I think he's going to, his Justice Department is going to appeal this ruling, and rightfully so, in a election season like this, that's kind of a no-brainer. I think the interesting question is almost whether he can he can co-opt this, or he can begin to pull this back, this event, as I think he started to do with the National Prayer Breakfast. Mm-hmm. And the folks that run that, he talks the God talk, and walks the God walk better than, even George W. Bush at times. And he can make these events his own if he chooses to. He hasn't, again, he didn't actually participate at the events, National Prayer, Day of Prayer, last year, but certainly mm-hmm. at the National Prayer Breakfast, he's wowed the room. And, if he's in for a few years, can he bring these back into kind of the center, make it more of a civic ritual as much as a partisan sectarian ritual?
Right. It seems like it could be easier to do that with the prayer breakfast, just because even though the group that sponsors that is still controversial, it at least makes more effort to be a broader, diverse gathering than the National Day of Prayer, which really it is hard to make the case that a president, and especially a Democratic president, has to participate in this very kind of narrow sectarian event. I've been waiting, and I'll probably be waiting for the rest of my life, for somebody to go after things like this from the pro-religion case, to say that it's actually calls into question how strong your faith is and how strong your religion is if you need a national proclamation to have a day of prayer. It's the same reaction I have every year with the war on Christmas. The idea that I need some Walmart greeter to say Merry Christmas to me instead of Happy Holidays in order to make my religious holiday meaningful it seems to me there's a religious case to go after stuff like that.
But on the other hand, I think you can you know, make the case that this could be a very broad recognition of the, you know, widest possible kind of religious ritual or affirmation that people can make. I mean, Obama has actually made, you know, included in his various proclamations the you know, those who do not pray or do not believe,
right,
recognizing
he
agnostics
does that
and atheists.
Every time.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and in and of itself, including everybody in this kind of memorial type of observance, again, gets back to that sort of civic religion that I think has been lost in many respects, and these things could be representative of that at their lowest common denominator, some would see it, but are legitimate parts of society and culture building, I think.
It's true. That's a good point. And he probably has done more than any other, certainly more than any other president, but maybe even any other Democratic figure, to kind of slip that in to broaden the spectrum of who's an acceptable, you know, person of faith or a person of moral standing. And every time he says, you know, those of many faiths and no faith at all, that reminds people that that's an acceptable position.
Mm-hmm.
I again, just do wonder whether the National Day of Prayer that, again, calls on all Americans to pray is maybe not the most effective way to do that.
Well, it's so very Christian, so very evangelical Christian, and it's the Dobsons. I mean, Dobson just came out with it. They're having a rally, I think, in Washington this weekend. He's talking about this is the greatest spiritual depth that the country has sunk to since the Civil War. You know, those are fighting words. How do you engage that, and how do you engage a guy like that and his wife over, you know, what's supposed to be a National Day of Prayer?
Mm-hmm. Well, then again, at this time last year, all we were talking about were the protests at Notre Dame. And those seem to have been not completely disappeared, but as you said, very well handled by Obama and his speech there last May. Take that opportunity to kind of take control and make the message his own there.
There's also there's the injection of the Islamic element into the event this year with the rejection, the disinvitation of Franklin Graham to the Pentagon event, portion of the event on National Day of Prayer. He's going to be participating at Capitol Hill itself in the events, but because of his previous statements, very harsh statements regarding not just Muslims, but the Islamic religion itself, I think which kind of went beyond the Jesus is the only way sort of Christian statement of belief. You know, and so that was put in there. And so, of course, that got the hackles up of a lot of Christians, and as well as a lot of Islamic advocacy groups who did not want him to be represented at any of these events.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, whatever you think of the disinvitation, we can certainly talk about that since Franklin Graham had his chance to chat with President Obama last weekend at his dad's home. You have to wonder who was in charge of the invitations for the Pentagon event, because again, it seems time after time, the folks who are inviting people like Rick Warren and Franklin Graham maybe aren't aware of kind of what the blowback could be to having these figures involved in government events.
Yeah, you really do have to wonder who's doing these things, especially since it was only a few weeks ago that Tony Perkins with the Family Research Council was uninvited from a military-related prayer breakfast at Andrews Air Force Base. And again, over his, you know, rather sharp remarks and campaigning against a repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy in the military. Perkins, a former Marine, I believe. So, you know, these kinds of things are can be foreseen. But again, I think this is the praxis. This is the way things have been going. These are the kind of invitations that were given out routinely during the Bush administration. But, you know, there's a new president in town, and it's taken them a little bit little while to catch up with things. But I think it would have been an interesting conversation down there in Montreat, North Carolina, at Billy Graham's house.
Yeah, it would have been very good to be a fly on the wall there. And maybe even a better idea. You know, it's interesting. I don't believe Graham was on the invitation list for that prayer breakfast that the White House held right after Easter a few weeks ago. Would have made more sense to include the Tony Perkins and the Franklin Grahams at an event like that if you wanted to be reaching out to them rather than necessarily featuring them as speakers.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You know, and again, you know, you can't afford to diss the Graham dynasty. No matter what.
You don't need to, but inviting them and then having to withdraw that invitation it is even worse than not inviting them to begin with.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's our advice to the White House. Take it or leave it. Did you want to get in to the Mojave case anymore with the cross?
Well, that's an interesting. I just think it's a fascinating case. Yeah, really, this case, again, much like the National Day of Prayer case, which I don't think is really going to go very far. But this cross, again, the Mojave Desert cross, it was a case about a longstanding case about a cross that had been erected there in honor of World War I veterans on federal land. And it was really a very technical kind of case about whether the federal government could transfer this little patch of land over to a private group so that they could continue to have this cross on this land. It wouldn't technically be federal land. And even whether the person, the former park ranger who was bringing the suit, had standing to bring the suit, et cetera. It got very technical. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure really how many ramifications it has.
Right.
But, you know, I think, again, one thing, the political ramifications will be there and will be played up to the hilt, especially in view of a pending Supreme Court nomination, which we can talk about in a minute. But, you know, there's also the interesting aspect of these cases, whether it's In God We Trust on the money, the you know, saying under God and the Pledge of Allegiance, having a cross in a courtroom or on public land someplace, is that you get conservative Christians so often arguing that these things should be able to be there because they don't have the sectarian meaning that the complainants say they do. So it just seems like an odd paradox that you've got people saying we need to keep these things to defend our Christian character as a nation, but
in order
to do that, they're arguing that these things aren't really Christian.
Right.
That they're universal kind of civic religious symbols, which kind of rubs me the wrong way. It just seems like a cross is a cross is a cross, and it should be.
Well, it should rub people the wrong way for whom the cross is actually a pretty meaningful symbol. But it also raises the question of whether a lot of the defenders think the cross is simply a civic symbol because they are making the argument that the U.S. is a Christian country and therefore, it's impossible to separate the one from the other, which is a problematic argument in and of itself. But I think you are right with this particular case that we're already hearing folks obviously on both sides reading all sorts of conclusions into it. But it does seem like the questions were narrow enough and the issue of whether it was appropriate to transfer the land is different than the issue of whether it's okay to have a sectarian religious symbol on government land, which is, I think, what a lot of people are thinking the case is.
Yeah, and of course, this isn't going to stop the political or lobby groups on either side from making hay over it. And again, particularly in light of the forthcoming expected nomination of a replacement for Justice John Paul Stevens on the Supreme Court.
Right. Well, why don't we move on to that? Because there's certainly in the list or the short list that keep floating around do not seem to be solid mainline Protestant or evangelical Protestant members, which means that we're probably looking at a new kind of court makeup that we've ever seen before.
Yeah, not only are we no longer a Christian nation, no longer a Protestant nation. When did that happen?
Well, as we know, it's been happening in terms of the numbers and the breakdown of Americans and their religious affiliations. But it does seem like, I don't know, maybe a symbolic change that's at the same time worth remarking on, and yet may not mean a heck of a lot. You know, the fact that we have, what is it, 6 Catholics now on the court,
right.
Doesn't necessarily tell you a lot when you compare, you know, Justice Alito with Justice Sotomayor. Their Catholicism is very, very different and isn't necessarily going to lead them to come to the same conclusions on cases because they're approaching it as Catholics.
Mm-hmm. And in some ways, in many respects, they are typical Catholics in the sense that there is no more typical Catholics. Catholics are the swing vote politically. They're almost split down the middle in terms of Republican,
sure,
Democratic identity and where they're going to go. Their party affiliation isn't that strong. But also you have different types of Catholics. I think, you know, in one respect, you know, what we're saying and what I agree with is that the religious labels don't matter as much anymore for all kinds of reasons, cultural and even theological, as they did once before. Gender, race, ethnicity, those are the seats that,
right,
you know, are reserved
status
on the court, I think, more than ever. But you do, again, in Alito and Scalia and Roberts, you've got a certain type of Catholic mind, almost a kind of a classical, you know, scholastically educated, scholastic bent of mind, that kind of originalist view. And then you've got the Sotomayor, more, let's say, social justice kind of, you know, pastorally inclined sort of Catholic. And you see that kind of division out there in the Catholic, in Catholic voters, in the Catholic churches, in theology, right down the line through the church.
You do, and I have to agree with you in terms of kind of the broad diversity of folks in the Catholic community, and certainly as we saw in the last election. I'm not sure still, though, that we can trace that back to different strains of Catholicism. You know, for instance, I'm not convinced that Obama ended up winning over Catholic voters in 2008 because his campaign used phrases like the common good. And try to broaden the definition of what it means to be pro-life. I think that can help him communicate with Catholic voters, but I think those Catholics in 2008 were voting based on the economy and doesn't tell us a heck of a lot about how their Catholicism moved them as much as how their economic position moved them in the last election.
But I think
and the same thing here. We have two different types of Catholics on the court. But again, I'm not sure it tells us a lot about their specific types of Catholicism so much as it tells us about them as whole individuals of which their faith is one part.
Hmm. Well, I think there is, because in the court, I think you can isolate things a little bit more, you know, apart from the economic and political and cultural winds a bit, to the intellectual approaches. You know, it's almost the intellectual approaches to the law are almost like a theological mindset, frame of mind. And I think those are, you know, those can be valid. I just think, you know, isn't there still a Protestant mindset that we could talk about, a kind of classic Protestant mindset, even, you know, even perhaps a Jewish approach to the law that would be different in the certain sense of a more rabbinic tradition and sense of, you know, arguing through the possibilities rather than, you know, certain types of Catholic approaches, not all of them, which, you know, stress the principle and the precept above all and the original intent.
Oh, I think there definitely are different approaches that come out of those traditions in terms of how to approach the law. I'm just questioning whether these particular individuals have those. I don't see necessarily in Justice Sotomayor a judicial approach or an intellectual approach that is grounded in Catholic social thought. Maybe it's there, but her background is not necessarily heavily in the church, which is mm-hmm. fine. She's probably very similar to a lot of Americans in terms of being culturally Catholic. And she says, you know, she most goes to church now when she's attending baptisms and other family events. But I would say, you know, it's probably the same if you look at the influence of the Jewish approach to the law in Justice Breyer. You know, he has talked about kind of his Judaism and the fact that, you know, even within his own family, one of his daughters is an Episcopal priest. And so he probably has, more than a lot of people, good insight into how religious traditions mix together and work with each other, but isn't necessarily coming out of a strong rabbinic approach.
And of course, Justice Scalia, the quintessential Catholic, many would say, on the court, takes offense at the idea that his religion or any religion would influence his decisions. The law is the law. The Constitution is the Constitution as he sees it, and that's a fair and an appropriate approach. I don't think many of his conservative fans take him at his word or really, you know, would want to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Right. They're hoping that you can read something into the fact that there's a majority Catholic court now.
But I think, you know, the real issue here, and, you know, I'd like to get your take on it. I mean, look, evangelicals are the engine of American religion today, and there's no real evangelical seat on the court. Is that just a question of, you know, a community that needs to intellectually mature? I mean, you've got some really strong law schools at evangelical universities at this point. Mm-hmm. Is it just a question of kind of a critical mass of evangelical jurists, you know, rising to that level?
It may be, you know, that may be something that we're going to see in the next 10 to 20 years as, you know, the evangelical elites that my former colleagues at Princeton, Michael Lindsay, has been exploring kind of the rise of that class within evangelicalism. And maybe it just hasn't matured to the point of having folks who would be nominees of that level yet. You know, Bush tried to add an evangelical to the Supreme Court with the short-lived nomination of Harriet Myers. But even then, it seems like it was just kind of a token attempt by his White House, because I would argue there were other qualified evangelicals that they could have pointed to, but they were almost more concerned about just having someone that they could pitch to the community and say, see, we're putting one of you on the court. And the fact that it wasn't a terribly carefully thought through decision just ended up backfiring with them, because it certainly didn't win them a lot of points with evangelicals to put up somebody who didn't necessarily have the strength to make it through the whole process.
And who who wasn't necessarily seen as a kind of a strong evangelical presence either. I mean, I think Ken Starr, the newly appointed president of Baylor University, a non-Baptist,
exactly.
of all things, you know, take away Monica Gate and the Starr investigation, and you know, he's someone who could have been a contender.
He absolutely could have, if you can take away those things.
I'd love to see
that nomination fight. You know, you can make an argument, and I have in the past, that maybe Clarence Thomas should be better characterized or labeled as a evangelical than a Catholic. He's been going to a pretty evangelical Anglican Episcopal church out in Virginia for a long time now. But he's technically a Catholic, so he's grouped in with the six on the court. But even there, you're right. White evangelicals are obviously a very powerful part of the American political structure and a large, vibrant part of American society as well, and just simply aren't represented in the same kinds of numbers because they don't have the same kind of built-in intellectual traditions, or have it. when it comes to approaches to the law and other areas that Catholics have. And it may take them quite a while to catch up with Catholics on that score.
I think it's also because they've got the political baggage. That's where they've invested so much of their time and resources and intellectual juice, I think, in recent decades is in politics. And I do think you've seen, you know, a tempering of that, or at least a balancing out of that. You know, even during the Bush era, as you saw a number of disaffected evangelicals. And so, you know, I think it could be an interesting time when you get the first self-identified evangelical finally nominated. Don't know whether it would be under the Obama administration, but we'll see.
A liberally evangelical judge.
Yes, exactly.
Well, yeah, we should probably move on, but I don't want to let that pass without saying that that's a great point that raises a question I had not thought of before, which is, you know, a lot of people, including me, when I tend to tell the history of what led to the rise of the religious right, look at the series of Supreme Court decisions, including in the 60s, taking prayer out of schools and declaring it unconstitutional to have Bible reading in public schools. Those things really started to mobilize evangelicals and bring them back into political engagement. But as you point out, that went almost entirely in the direction of pure politics and electoral politics. And it is a question about why someone in the evangelical community didn't say, maybe if it's, you know, these judicial rulings that are really riling us, we should start investing, at least funnel some of our folks into the legal realm. And I think, you know, with the Federalist Society, you started to see some people entering that arena, but not in the really concentrated effort way that we saw with electoral politics.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah.
That's a question for the history books.
So
as you mentioned earlier, you did get back from Rome recently. Anything going on there?
Good pasta, good pizza, tough gig. I call it the Vatican the ecclesiastical version of the panic room. Now they've kind of, you know, barred themselves all inside with enough provisions they hope to kind of outlast this latest scandal, this latest
round.
And
they do think they can outlast it.
They do think they can outlast it. As they say, the Vatican thinks in terms of centuries, not in terms of news cycles. You know, you just can't, they've got to get ahead of it somehow. I mean, you would think they would have to get ahead of it. I think one of the things that is important to remember about this, you know, again, we've gone through so many of these news cycles of revelations of scandals, 85, the early 1985, the early 90s, then 2002, obviously, and now these revelations, again, of older cases or cases relative many years ago, but of, you know, not everything from mismanagement to abject failures on the part of bishops and even Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger before he was Pope to, you know, flush these guys out of the priesthood or to make sure they didn't abuse kids again. You know, but the thing that's different here and the thing that's different from all of the, really all of the controversies and conflicts between American Catholics and the Vatican that we've written so much about since the 1960s, really, and especially since Humana Vitae and the encyclical against birth control, is that this isn't just a disagreement over doctrine. This is, or over teachings, or over the roles of gays and women and lay people in the church, that kind of thing. This is really a question, a point where you have Catholics themselves questioning the character of the Pope and whether he's being completely truthful, whether he's being Christian enough for a man who's occupying the chair of St. Peter. Even if people disagreed vehemently with John Paul II on many of his policies, centralizing policies, his more traditional views on church discipline and doctrine, they always respected him very much, and they he was beloved. I mean, you didn't, you know, we Catholics could criticize the Pope, but don't you dare, you know, don't any outsiders criticize him. He's our Pope. And that seems to be changing a bit in this latest go-round, and I think that's a dangerous point for the church to be at, because as Paul the Sixth said, I can no longer command, I have to convince. And if people aren't listening to the Pope, if they're dismissing him as not being on the up and up as much as he should be, then they're in serious trouble.
Right. Well, and I wonder how much it hurts that particularly in the last few weeks we've seen some more recent cases coming out, because it does seem to a certain extent it would have been tough to find anyone to fill the role to be Pope who didn't have some connection to that period of the 60s, 70s, 80s, when there were, multiple cases of abuse going on, and people within the church were aware of it. It just seemed to be kind of very pervasive, and there weren't a whole lot of figures who could have been elected who could have said that their hands were completely clean and they didn't even know about anything.
Of all of them, Joseph Ratzinger was certainly the best bet. I mean, he spent a year after his ordination in 1952 in a parish, and that was really the extent of his parish work. The rest of his time was in academia. He was as a theologian. He was an expert at the Second Vatican Council from 1962 to 65. He was in various church agencies and bureaucracies. He was only a residential archbishop in Munich for less than 5 years, from 1977 to 1982, and then he went to the Vatican to be head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the chief doctrinal officer there, where he was policing theologians more than child abusers. There were very few cases really that came before him until 2001. So, you know, they're relatively, I mean, he, of all, would have the cleanest hands. And really, I have to say, if you took these cases out of the context of this wider controversy and outrage, the one case regarding a priest in 1980 back in Munich, who he allowed to come into the archdiocese for counseling, and then the man was reassigned to a parish where he went on to abuse other children, Ratzinger's former aides there said he had no idea that this man was being reassigned. That's one case 30 years ago. Then a few handful of other cases that came before him when he was at the Vatican, head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, where he obviously didn't act very quickly, didn't do very much to get these guys out of the priesthood in the 1990s. Again, if you just take these cases out of the context, they're not deal breakers. They're not anything to resign over. They're not anything to promote outrage. In effect, Cardinal Ratzinger was acting like most bishops of the time. It's just that you have two things. You've got this context of tremendous outrage, these other revelations showing that bishops across the board haven't been forthright and haven't put everything out there that they should. And you've got the fact that Pope Benedict XVI hasn't spoken himself on this. He hasn't really talked about what he knew and when he knew it. He hasn't talked about why he made those decisions back then. If he had gotten out, I mean, people in the Curia I talked to, conservative Catholics I talked to, they all say if he had come out, gotten ahead of this thing, come out right away and just talked to people, talked to the press, talked openly, said, I wish, you know, if I'd known then what I know now, I wish I'd acted more prudently and acted more aggressively, I don't think this would be an issue.
Right, but that's not how the Vatican works.
That's not how Pope Benedict XVI.
We know what the rules are, that, you know, the cover-up is worse than the crime. You're supposed to disclose as much as you know at the beginning. It'll be so much better. And yet, it's hard to imagine the Pope coming out and following those rules like any other politician. I certainly agree it would have served him better. But I wonder if there's even the mentality to propose, much less accept that approach over there.
No, they don't want to. And that's also a function of who Joseph Ratzinger is, Pope Benedict XVI. He doesn't like to apologize. He doesn't really think that he's done anything wrong or that there's anything worth apologizing for. His apologies, by the way, are always on behalf of the church for the sins of other of these priests. For him, he's a moralist at heart, and for him, the crime and the sin that is at fault here is that of the abusive, molesting priests. As for the bishops who failed to oversee them, those are cases of, at times, gross mismanagement, as he says, but there aren't necessarily reasons to make a wholesale purge of the hierarchy. There have been three or four men who've submitted their resignations because of these things in Ireland. If a bishop himself has abused a child, he will immediately be dispensed with, and his resignation will be accepted. But if it's a case of mismanagement, shuffling priests around, covering up for them, he's not going to necessarily call for their resignation. So there's almost like two different conversations going on here. Mm-hmm. The Pope is looking at this, and the people in the Vatican are looking at the sins of the priests. The bishops, or the people in the pews, I'm sorry, are looking at the bishops, are looking at the upper management,
right,
looking for accountability and transparency. And they're not getting it because the Vatican has circled the wagons and they're blaming the media. And there's been plenty of tough criticism about the Vatican for them to complain about, but that's really not a winning strategy if public opinion is the battle you're interested in winning.
So can we expect that this will not die down anytime soon? Like, because we won't see anything coming out of the Vatican that is intended to try to address and diffuse it.
I think there will be some policies here and there that they're going to enact and they'll be able to point to and that kind of thing. But no, I think they're just going to gut it out. And I think it's going to potentially really damage Benedict's credibility, his platform for preaching, and his reputation. I think we're seeing the first line of his obituary being written.
Well, it has the potential, as you said at the beginning, to damage the church itself, just because he is not the type of figure that John Paul was. We've seen the numbers after the scandals in 2002, 2001 came out in terms of American Catholics leaving the church. You expand that, at least to Europe, if not worldwide, and that becomes a much larger problem for the church.
But on the other hand, as Philip Jenkins, a great scholar of global Christendom, wrote in the New Republic today, you know, the Catholicism is a booming market in the Southern Hemisphere, in Africa, in Asia, and Latin America. So the Vatican can sit tight and they can say, look, you know, that's where our future is. We'll look to the South, Europe, North America, you know, if they can do what they like.
That would be interesting to watch the Vatican forfeit Europe.
Yeah, well, you know, that would be recovering Christendom for Europe was one of Benedict's prime goals, and he's not going
right.
to give up on that. But he's just turned 83, so you know, it's a really problematic time for the church, and to see, you know, I wondering how much these kinds of things are going to really impact Catholicism on the ground here in the United States. I think some of the political disputes that we've seen here could have, frankly, almost a greater impact than even the European scandals and the reputation of the Pope. I think, again, we were going to talk about healthcare reform a little bit, but I think the fallout in that dispute, you know, between the bishops and the nuns, for example, which is continuing as you've gotten bishops here sort of barring nuns from conducting vocations campaigns in their dioceses because certain orders of nuns backed healthcare reform for legitimate prudential reasons, I think. I mean, when you see that kind of thing, you know, you're seeing a real civil war going on in Catholicism that's going to discourage people or anger Catholics, I think, more than anything.
Well, and the fact that it's not over theological issues, but as you said, these are political fights. It is something that makes it tougher for a lot of Catholics to stand by and just watch happen.
Exactly.
But we have just a little bit of time left here, so maybe we can do the church a favor and move on to a topic where they are taking a fairly popular leadership stance right now, and that's immigration reform, where the Bishops' Conference in particular has been very outspoken this week in opposing the new law in Arizona about enforcement of immigration laws. And in particular, Cardinal Mahoney in Los Angeles, who, as you know, has been a longtime advocate of immigrants, has really just been blistering in terms of attacking the law. He was calling it on his blog similar to the policies of Nazi Germany and Communist Russia in terms of compelling citizens to turn others in. There's both the opposition to the law in Arizona, but it's going on at the same time that the church has really been the head of a religious coalition pushing for Democrats to take up immigration reform and not wait until after the midterms, but to do it now to make sure that that gets through this year. As I said earlier, it did seem late last week like they had gotten some momentum and that maybe even the Arizona law would push that over the edge. Harry Reid had talked about taking it up regardless of whether or not they could get Republicans to come on board, and Obama last weekend was sounding like this was something he was going to actually play a leadership role on as well, which, like healthcare, was what they needed to actually get it to go through. They're both backing off of those statements this week. The president on Wednesday evening said that there just might not be the appetite for this year, which is kind of a passive way of putting it. There's appetite if he has appetite for it. But it's interesting, particularly in the wake of healthcare, which did kind of end up as a bruising battle with religious groups kind of facing off on both sides, to see an issue like immigration reform that can get almost all of the religious players on board on the same side pushing for it, which, if they can't get it done, it's hard to think of the lineup that could.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, but how much, again, this is one of those Catholic change-ups where, a few months ago they were blistering the Obama administration over healthcare reform and ostensible funding of abortion. Now they're, equally blistering on what could be considered the liberal side of things, for immigration. But what about evangelicals and what about, the religious right? How much are they going to, push Republicans to go for healthcare reform? Lindsey Graham seems to have been the main or the lone Republican voice out there, the senator from South Carolina.
Yeah, he has basically said he's not comfortable being the only one. But if another Republican came on board as co-sponsor, then he would be willing to continue pushing this with Chuck Schumer. So it's interesting because that is where the focus has been for the religious groups who are lobbying on this, is to find another Republican. And just a couple of weeks ago, the National Association of Evangelicals and World Relief, which is the Christian International Aid Group, co-sponsored an event up in New Hampshire, which was ostensibly to do some church education for pastors to kind of clear up questions about immigration and immigrants themselves. But was really to put pressure on Judd Gregg, who they have targeted as a possible Republican who could sign on as a co-sponsor. And it is the involvement of evangelicals that is different this time, because you're right, Catholics have a long history of supporting immigration reform. In fact, throughout their opposition to health reform, the bishops mentioned every time they talked about abortion, as well, they're concerned that health reform didn't sufficiently cover undocumented immigrants. And they at least said that that was one of the reasons that they were opposing health reform. But this is really, if not a new issue for all evangelicals, it's surprising to see evangelicals taking such a visible role. The NAE passed unanimously a resolution last fall calling for a path to citizenship to be involved in comprehensive immigration reform. And I would say that's a pretty significant change within the evangelical community. Now, it has been controversial in some corners, but the fact that the NAE could do that with not a single dissenting member of the board tells you there's something going on in evangelical churches. And I would say it's at least in part related to the fact that you've got a lot of immigrants in evangelical churches these days. A lot of Hispanic churches are what's really growing in the evangelical community.
And I mean, yeah, it's really, the Democratic Party looks out there and the Republican Party probably should as well, and sees the growing Latino presence, the growing immigrant presence, and sees that as potential future voters. The Catholic Church, is continuing to grow in the United States, but only because of immigration.
Right.
And again, you know, the evangelicals are honest and look out there and see what's going on, see that picture as well. But I think, you know, they've still got a tough battle, I think, within their own community. And you've got, you know, this is the year of the Tea Party. And again, I think this goes back to some of those concerns that a number of people across the religious spectrum, religious right, the classic religious right to the religious left, that the Tea Partiers are more libertarian than they are, you know, moral conservatives and social justice types. So, you know, can they, is there enough weight out there in the evangelical community to turn a couple of critical votes in Congress to immigration reform?
Right. Well, at the same time, you know, you could actually argue that the religious right folks have kind of not had a rallying point this year. And I don't, I'm certainly not suggesting that immigration is going to be what brings them out of the woodwork. But they have kind of been an afterthought in the Tea Party movement. People keep trying to figure out whether there's a religious element to it. And while I don't doubt that people who think of themselves as part of the Tea Party may have religious affiliations, that's not what's motivating them to join the Tea Party. And it certainly, as you said, isn't along the spectrum of issues that we're seeing them talk about. I think it was the political poll last week of the people who came out to protest Tax Day found that you know, concern about gay marriage was at the very bottom of the list of concerns of the folks who were here with the Tea Party movement. And so, you know, again, not suggesting that immigration is going to be the big rallying point for people on the religious right, but at the same time, there isn't really anyone speaking to them right now. Sarah Palin maybe can get a few lines off, but she is not angling to be their leader. And, you know, the leadership of the old religious right is literally dying out. So, you know, there's some grappling within the evangelical community now to see who may be able to emerge, and even more importantly, what the issues are that are really going to motivate evangelicals in the coming years. And it's interesting that, you know, they are choosing to take something of a leadership role. Even Richard Land with the Southern Baptist Leadership Conference is pro-comprehensive reform. Mm. And, you know, he may not be the loudest voice out there and by choice, but that says something about the recognition that evangelicals are broadening their base of issues that they're interested in beyond abortion and gay marriage.
But yeah, and it's such a dicey political time now, and you see this kind of hedging by Obama and others and Harry Reid. You know, is it worth it? You know, can they afford to do it? But then again, can they afford not to do it? And there's a lot of intense lobbying going on from the faith groups for them to get it done. And, you know, are they going to, you know, this is really where it's going to, you know, that muscle is going to show or not.
Yeah, I think the president may hear his own phrase, the fierce urgency of now, uttered back at him on this issue. Because the religious groups are not looking to let up. But as you say, it's simply not going to happen if the White House decides it's got to wait until after the midterms. And with that, I think sadly we may have to put off my lament for the extinct pro-choice Republicans and going extinct pro-life Democrats for another time.
But we've gotten
a lot in here.
I know. No, this was great. My first time out. It went by, and I hope it goes by as quickly for viewers as it did for us. So,
well, I hope it was terrific. Painless.
So we'll tune into time.com for you, politicsdaily.com
and Politics
for me.
Daily. Yep. Absolutely. Well, and it was a pleasure talking with you, David.
You too, Amy.
We'll see this again soon.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Take care now.